Chapter 2 Perspectives. For all that beauty that doth cover thee is but the seemly raiment of my heart, which in thy breast doth live, as thine in me. Presume not on thy heart when mine is slain. Thou gavest me thine, not to give back again. Shakespeare, Sonnet 22. A symposium is a drinking party. The ancient Greeks, being wise enough to cut their wine with water, kept their wits. On the evening of the conversation related in Plato's Symposium, the members of the party decide to take turns making a speech in praise of love. For us, now, the dialogue is still fresh. It features several perspectives, some of which anticipate ways that modern thinkers have challenged the monopoly of poetry and literature on this elusive topic. Love and nature, the good and the bad. Phaedrus, the first speaker, praises love's power to motivate a person to excel. It improves character. The word character is used in two ways. As a descriptive term, it refers to what we can expect of someone's thoughts, values, and behavior. It is also a term of praise. To say someone is a character is to say they are interestingly eccentric, and so aesthetically appealing. Someone who has character is reliable, possessed of self-control, and otherwise morally praiseworthy. Both the aesthetic and the moral aspects of character were implied in the Greek's equivalent of gentleman, kalos kagathos, meaning handsome and good. The dialogue's first take on love, then, is that it is both beautiful and good. That theme has not ceased to be heard from Augustine's love and then do whatever you want to the contemporary cliché, all you need is love. Love matters for its power to move us, to feel, to think, to act in new ways. Sometimes, at least, it motivates us to be at our best. But only sometimes. Pausanias, the second to speak, elaborates on the qualifier. Love can motivate evil actions as well as good ones. Does that mean there must be two kinds of love? Not necessarily. There might be fair and foul means to a single aim of love. Suppose a preliminary aim of love is to be loved. Then acting well might be a means to secure the beloved's esteem. This need not be mercenary if the thought of the beloved inspires a desire to be truly worthy of being loved. Wanting to be loved is wanting to preserve one's own self-respect. Less commendably, however, in pursuit of the same goal of being loved, one might resort to calumny or murder to eliminate rivals. But that is not what Pausanias is talking about. He is contrasting not effects of love, but kinds of love. The good kind is of the soul, the bad kind is of the body. They are so different that they require different patron goddesses. Economically, though confusingly, both are named Aphrodite. One is heavenly, while the other is common. Pausanias is making a distinction still frequently taken for granted, that true love, which is higher, spiritual, and linked to our virtuous aspirations, and mere lust, which expresses lower instincts we share with non-human animals. Does this distinction rest on facts of nature? Its specific context in the symposium suggests that it does not. Everyone present at that party takes it for granted that the highest form of love is between a man and an adolescent boy. Most of our own contemporaries are apt to call that pedophilia. How could such perversion have been the norm in Plato's circle among brilliant men whose thinking still earns our respect after 2.5 millennia? Evidently, social expectations and practices have changed. That shows that the way we understand the distinction between higher and lower forms of love rests not on facts of nature, but at least partly on variable social norms. It is still widely assumed, however, that love admits of higher and lower forms. But why should we privilege one form of erotic love over another? Two reasons might be given. One appeals to the consequences of one or the other mode of love. From that point of view, the more altruistic form of love will be deemed the higher because altruism is conducive to social harmony. On this point, the record of lovers is mixed. When lovers are ensconced in the cocoon of their mutual adoration, their altruism is limited to one, and they are apt to forget the rest of the world. The other sort of reason for elevating some loves over others appeals to certain conceptions of the place of love and sex in human nature. Such conceptions have clustered around three basic models. The one proffered by Pausanias we can call the Puritan model. It posits a hierarchy of reason, emotion, and appetite. Reason is identified with our best and true self, and its rightful place is in control. Some versions of the Puritan model reduce it to a simple dichotomy between soul and body. Soul good, body bad. A second model simply inverts the first. It is equally puritanical, but regards the body as the only authentic self. We could call it the Laurentian model, after D.H. Lawrence, who sometimes wrote as if he thought that reason, logic, and perhaps civilization itself represented a corruption of the Edenic innocence of our sexual and bodily nature. A third model is the pansexual model, sometimes attributed to Freud. On this picture, sex is the single underlying source of all motivation. What appear to be purely intellectual or spiritual goals, including so-called higher forms of love, are merely sublimations of the sexual instinct, redirecting its aim, but not changing its source. On this third model, something of its original sexual character remains in the most highly sublimated form of sacred love, as famously illustrated in Bernini's statue, The Ecstasy of Saint Teresa. The form of love designated as what nature intended will depend on which of the three models, Puritan, Laurentian, or pansexual, is favored. The Christian tradition, for example, tends to take literally the dichotomy of soul and body, with their respective association to sacred and profane forms of love. To those brought up in that and some other traditions, the dichotomous conception of love goes without saying. But some cultures have regarded the ecstasy of physical love as an aspect or manifestation of sacred love, rather than an entirely different or incompatible phenomenon. Some versions of the tantric tradition, for example, regard sexual love as an essential manifestation of divinity, eschewing the dualism espoused by both Puritans and Laurentians. Even if we assume a duality of soul and body, it is not obvious that we should care more about the soul in this life. Plato's Socrates, later in this dialogue as well as elsewhere, argues that the soul is eternal and unchanging, while the body is just a temporary series of ephemeral episodes. That is adduced by him, as by some religions, as a reason to value and care for the soul and despise the body. But in the face of the eternal nature of the soul, the ephemeral character of the body might, on the contrary, seem a compelling reason to favor the body. You will have, quite literally, all the time in the world to pamper your soul. What are urgent are the claims of the body. The body's pleasures are the ones to be seized as they fly. Eternity will take care of itself. Something like this, with a gilding of paradox, is expressed in these lines of Blake. He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. He who kisses a joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. Love embodied. Eryximachus, a physician, speaks next. For him, mind-body duality is no reason to despise the body. On the contrary, cultivating the right kind of love is just one aspect of healthy living, which requires a balance of opposite elements. His view has affinities with the pansexual model, for his prescription for balance extends to music, science, and religion. We can hardly be surprised that, from the point of view of modern brain science, what he has to say is not very informative. Yet, two things are significant about it. One is the very fact that such a physiological perspective is presented at all. Plato, for all his commitment to a reality beyond that of everyday sensory experience, anticipates the importance that modern thinkers will ascribe to the physiological and neural substrate of love. The modern science of love confirms the hunch that the craziness of love is more than accidentally similar to other forms of altered consciousness. Despite Plato's talk of higher forms of love pertaining to a potentially disembodied soul, the speech of Eryximachus reminds us that it is all happening in the body. The second point to note is that there is a tension between the healthy ideal of balance and the ideal of love. For love is not easily moderated. In the guise of limerence, it moves us to extremes of both feeling and behavior. There is a hint, perhaps, that love is inherently a state of unbalance, disruptive, and perhaps even unhealthy. In later literature, not a few have decried love as pathology. Shakespeare encapsulated this in Sonnet 147. "My love is as a fever, longing still for that which longer nurseth the disease, feeding on that which does preserve the ill, the uncertain, sickly appetite to please." The comic offer Aristophanes is up next. He proposes a myth about the origins of human beings that is also, in a very different way, grounded in a story about the body. His myth will explain two things: why love's yearning can feel so intensely painful, and why falling in love feels like finding a very specific and unique missing piece of yourself. Originally, Aristophanes fancies, our ancestors were spherical, eight-limbed creatures that came in three variants: male, female, and androgynous. These beings, by their success, aroused the ever-touchy Zeus to jealousy. To punish them, he sliced them in two. Our quest for love is really a quest for our other half. Aristophanes' myth is reminiscent of the creation of Eve from Adam's body in Genesis, although the longing to reunite with one's rib is perhaps less compelling. It is also similar to an Indian myth about the origin of the sexes. The Indian version, however, places more emphasis on love as relief from loneliness, for which any companion would serve, and there is less emphasis on love as a recognition of the beloved as oneself. In the beginning, this world was just a single body shaped like a man. He looked around and saw nothing but himself. That first being became afraid. Therefore, one becomes afraid when one is alone. Then he thought to himself, "Of what should I be afraid when there's no one but me?" So his fear left him. For what was he going to be afraid of? One is, after all, afraid of another. He found no pleasure at all, so one finds no pleasure when one is alone. He wanted to have a companion. Now, he was as large as a man and a woman in close embrace, so he split his body into two, giving rise to husband and wife. Aristophanes' story captures two features of the experience of love: the longing we feel to unite with a particular person, and the gender specificity of the person who is the object of that longing. The desire for union draws attention to the feeling of recognition that falling in love often brings, the sense that it is as if I have known you forever, or even, as Aristotle said, of friendship in general, that the other is a second self. If the beloved was and is to be again just another part of myself, then that explains both my desire to physically unite our bodies and my sense that whatever the other wants will be what I want as well. In other respects, Aristophanes' story sits awkwardly with the facts of experience. It doesn't explain why not everybody is in love. Not everyone longs for union, either in general or with someone in particular. And while the myth of original eight-limbed beings presents a neat way of accounting for different sexual orientations, one might complain that it does nothing to explain why some people are bisexual or polyamorous. Still, Aristophanes' fantasy is suggestive. It captures the intensity of longing and the tendency we have to speak of one's self uniting with another. When we think about the mechanism of sexual fertilization, moreover, the fantasy of a merger of two beings seems to represent a literal truth. Although it is hardly a truth of which we can plausibly claim any awareness, the reality of the physical merger that produces a new human individual may encourage lovers to take seriously the metaphor of merging selves. The big difference between the two sorts of mergers, of course, is that in the myth, once we reach our goal, the original unity is recovered. In the biological parallel, the union of sperm and ovum creates a zygote unlike any other that ever has or ever will exist. In that respect, the myth, unsurprisingly, falls short of the reality. The Ladder of Love. In the next two speeches, a subtle debate is joined, sparked by Agathon's praise of the perfection of love. His speech indulges in all the excesses of unfettered rhetoric, and it functions mainly as a foil for Socrates to refute. The refutation begins with a particularly cutting example of the irony for which Socrates was famous. Proclaiming his admiration for Agathon's masterly tribute to love, Socrates professes his inability to match it. "I now see," he says, "that the intention was to attribute to love every species of greatness and glory, whether really belonging to him or not, without regard to truth or falsehood. Now, saying things without regard to truth or falsehood has been declared to be the very definition of bullshit." In praising Agathon as too brilliant to emulate, Socrates is actually telling him that he was talking bullshit, which might well rate, come to think of it, among the most ancient traditions in talk about love. Having got that out of the way, Socrates undertakes an ingenious analytic argument designed to show that love could not be beautiful or godlike. That challenges Greek tradition, of course, for apart from the fact that Greek gods were famous for their amorous exploits, two divine figures, the goddess Aphrodite and the troublesome boy god Eros, personified love. Socrates develops his rejection of love as divine into an elaborate doctrine. To preserve his pose of never having any doctrine of his own, Socrates claims to have learned it from a priestess named Diotima. The view in question is often taken to be Plato's real view, but since Plato is careful to attribute the story to someone who relates that Socrates got it from Diotima, I shall refer to it as Diotima's doctrine. Love involves desire, and desire is typically for what we lack. The English word want conveniently conveys both meanings. If you want something, you are in want of it, which just means you don't have it. So love is essentially a lack. It aspires to or desires what it does not possess. Although you can't want what you already have, it can seem like you do because you want it to continue into the next moment. If you possess beauty now, you want to keep it. But for how long? If you had to decide how long a given pleasure will last, you might allow for the possibility that even the greatest pleasures pall. You might try to estimate how long it will remain enjoyable. That doesn't occur to Diotima. Instead, she makes three remarkably illogical moves. The first is to assume that one would want it to last forever. And if, as has been already admitted, love is of the everlasting possession of the good, all men will necessarily desire immortality together with good. Perhaps this is made plausible by the assumption that possessing beauty and goodness is the highest possible satisfaction. And yet one can scarcely imagine enjoying a peak experience, however pleasant, for any great length of time. Habituation would set in, or the intensity of pleasure would transform it into pain. So this first move is a leap. Then comes a sort of sleight of hand in which the object of love gets switched before our very eyes. First, love was the desire for unending contemplation of beauty and goodness, and suddenly it's the unendingness itself that we desire. Wherefore, love is of immortality. Now, it may well be true that we have, or that some people have, a desire for immortality as such, and when we agree with the conclusion, we often don't care how bad the argument is that purports to support it. So, the illogicality of moving from wanting something specific forever to wanting to live forever for its own sake passes unnoticed. The third illogical twist suddenly brings in reproduction, the desire for which appears to be explained as a sort of consolation prize for our impossible desire for immortality. Because, to the mortal creature, generation is a sort of eternity and immortality. Diotima here seems to anticipate Woody Allen, who famously declared he would prefer to achieve immortality by not dying. The idea here seems to be that if you are unable to achieve union with divine beauty itself, you will have to settle for procreation. That is how the connection between love, sex, and reproduction is brought up. In what looks like an afterthought, the desire for offspring is explained as a side effect of the original goal of eternal contemplation of ideal beauty. Reproduction is second best, but it's all that ordinary folk can aspire to. Freudian sublimation is a kind of inversion of that Platonic view. Freud thought that artists substitute artistic goals, such as beauty, for sex. Plato, on the contrary, held that we substitute sex and reproduction for the unattainable object of our original desire for beauty. Here again, which of the two seems more plausible to you probably says more about your temperament than about the superiority of one model over the other. The illogicality of these three moves is not entirely to be deplored. In a great philosopher, illogicality can be instructive. In the present case, although all three of the moves just described are questionable, they draw our attention to some vivid intuitions we have about the experience of love and our attitude to death. First, the assumption that you will never want an end to the contemplation of beauty reflects the fact that when you are in the grip of limerence, the knowledge of its ephemeral nature cannot overcome the conviction that it will last forever. The first of Diotima's moves is a kind of metonymic representation of that fact of experience. The second illogical shift from desiring to contemplate beauty forever to desiring merely to exist forever again signals a strong inclination to believe the conclusion regardless of the reason for it. All the better not to think about it, for it could not stand scrutiny. While it might make sense to wish that love, or for that matter any happy state, will not be ended by death, the prospect of eternity should lose all its attraction unless the quality of life eternal is guaranteed. Plato regarded anything that isn't eternal as not quite real. That might have led him to forget about the possibility that eternity might not be all that pleasant. The third shift, from immortality to generation, seems at first unsurprising. Of course, you might think, having children is a kind of immortality. But actually, it is nothing of the kind. The apparent obviousness of the move just occludes its irrationality. However much you invest in pretending otherwise, your child isn't you. The good news is that even if you never have children at all, you will still contribute to future life. You will just do so in a more roundabout way, through the maggots and bacteria that will return your flesh to the immortal circle of life. The idea that love yearns for what it lacks also hints at a darker truth, exploited by much art and literature. Love is frequently painful, and its quest for perfection often focuses on the illusory or the unattainable. When it is consummated, in both myth and reality, it is often extinguished in death, or else fails to outlast the little death of orgasm and the thousand cuts of daily life. Diotima evades that darker truth by dissociating love altogether from actual persons. As the lover reflects on why he loves, he is expected to realize that the boy whose beauty and goodness first charmed him is merely the first rung on a ladder of love. The beloved imperfectly exemplifies lovable beauty. In all consistency, then, the lover should extend his love to all beautiful boys, for if beauty was reason enough to love one, it must be reason enough to love all. Not stopping at this pleasantly egalitarian promiscuity, the ideal lover will soon concentrate his attention on the ideal, otherworldly perfection of beauty itself. That ideal form of beauty is then revealed to have been, all along, the true object of his love. In this way, what Socrates preaches through the fiction of Diotima is systematic infidelity to the loved individual, jilted in favor of his beauty. This idea is preposterous, yet many people have been inspired by its intimation of love's power to transcend our daily preoccupations and bring us to another realm of being. It is also another reminder of the close ties of love to both art and religious fervor. The best love poetry, even at its most personal, owes much of its power to its transfiguration of particular occasions into universal meaning. The return of the particular. Diotima's fantasy is not the end of the dialogue, although it has often been thought to be its climax. The last speech is given by the drunken Alcibiades, famed golden bad boy of Athens, who tells of his own unsuccessful attempt to seduce Socrates. That story inverts the normal expectation of the older man seducing the younger, but it chimes with the emphasis on moral and intellectual beauty that spurred the lover to climb Diotima's ladder. What captivates Alcibiades is the inner beauty of Socrates, not his physique — he was notoriously ugly — but the fact that the young man can be so intensely taken by that particular person, Socrates, undermines Diotima's claim that only beauty itself is worth loving. It restores the mysterious centrality of the concrete human individual as the real object of love. For it is Socrates, the living individual, that Alcibiades desires, not some abstract quality he embodies, however admirable. How exactly the individual's qualities work to arouse love, however, is a question that raises puzzles of its own. What is erotic propriety? In the Symposium, certain norms are taken for granted: the superiority of love between man and adolescent boy, the second-rate nature of love for a woman, the etiquette of erotic pursuit, who should chase and who should be chased. In thus subverting the normal etiquette of pursuit, Alcibiades' story makes a turning point in the dialogue. The question can now be put more generally: in what sorts of relationships is it appropriate to expect erotic love? Who among wives, husbands, friends, cousins, children, parents, or mankind as a whole can make an appropriate subject or object of love? Who is taboo? And what decides those judgments of appropriateness? The answers actually given in any given society are apt to be justified in terms of the naturalness of the sentiments in question. But we have already seen, in the large distance between Greek conventions and our own, that some of these assumptions are a product of local custom. They are, as the phrase goes, socially constructed, most likely our feeling for what is just natural is illusory. One attitude, however, seems to have remained the same from Plato's time to ours. The idea that love not only explains, but even excuses bad behavior. Love gets a special pass. In the pursuit of his love, says Pausanias, the custom of mankind allows him to do many strange things, which philosophy would bitterly censure if they were done from any motive of interest or wish for office or power. We'll find more reasons in the sequel to resist the temptation of looking at love through rose-colored glasses. An evolutionary perspective on love. Although Plato lacked the evolutionary model, some of the symposium speeches invoke a story about origins to explain love's characteristic desires and behaviors. Aristophanes' idea that the lover is in quest of his own other half, and Diotima's emphasis on the quest for immortality, both illustrate the way that origin stories can explain how things work. We now know a good deal about the shaping of human characteristics by chance and natural selection in the course of evolution. Inferences from that fact, however, involve much speculative reconstruction. They are unlikely to be entirely reliable or free of ideological presuppositions. Later, when we consider what light evolutionary theory casts on love, we shall need to tread warily, remembering from our reading of Plato that an allegiance to current social norms can lend unwarranted credibility to unlikely hypotheses, notably about the nature of love and the gender differences that may attend it. How does it feel, and why? What are the emotions that come with love, and what is it they make us want and do? Poets and novelists have until recently owned these questions, though most authors seem to have been much less interested in what it feels like to be loved than to love. Plato did not neglect them. The mythical origin of our own species, as half-beings looking for our other half, is a powerful metaphor for the feeling of intense and inevitable attraction for a specific person felt by lovers in a state of limerence. Some of the condition's most painful feelings of rejection and frustration are also evoked by Alcibiades' tale of his vain attempts to seduce Socrates. Here, too, modern knowledge can give us a fresh perspective on those feelings by tracing them to specific processes in the brain, which establish resemblances and differences between emotions that we experience as similar, yet different, such as erotic and maternal love. That theme, too, will be pursued later. But philosophers and psychologists have come to see that the character of experience depends not only on brain states, but also on contextual and social cues that guide our interpretation of that experience. Think, for example, of the powerful effect of placebos. Given a pill from which you expect certain effects, 30% or more of its impact can be accounted for as resulting from that expectation alone. That happens in the absence of any active chemical ingredient in the pill and is attested by both subjective experience in objective measurements. Much the same might be happening in many experiences of love. But what of the other 70%? When we come to look at the contemporary science of love, we shall have to be wary of explanations that just provide neural correlates for states we know from experience. Such correspondences may add no more to our understanding of love than naming the parts of the digestive system that will ward off stomach aches. On the other hand, if it shows us that certain states of mind and desire, such as those associated with religious ecstasy or with drug addiction, are driven by the very brain chemicals that drive limerence, this might cast a novel light on all of them. It might also suggest ways in which we could gain more control, should we wish to do so. Can love be analyzed? The discussion, so ably started by Diotima's doctrine, is characteristically philosophical. It contrasts with the other approaches, psychological, historical, mythical, or scientific, in being the sort of thing we now call conceptual analysis. What does that term mean? We could think of love as a composite of emotions or dispositions, simpler than itself. The identification of those simpler components is one sense of analysis. Or we could think of that word in the light of what it means in psychoanalysis. In the perspective offered by Eriksimachus, love is analyzed in terms of unconscious factors, such as harmony or discord in the lover's physiology. But the sense in which philosophers speak of conceptual analysis is different again. It is what Socrates goes in for when he questions Agathon about the relation of love to desire. The question of what counts as a desire is part of the kind of analysis we are looking for when we ask what love means. The way conceptual analysis operates when discussing love, however, seems to be more than an inquiry into meaning. Normally, a property is said to be essential for the application of a concept if, in the absence of that property, the concept doesn't apply. A triangle, for example, is a three-angled plane figure. That is logically incompatible with having more or fewer than three sides. We know that this is so, but we don't ask how the triangle feels about it. The case of love is different. Here we are inclined to let the person currently enduring the condition decide what counts as essential. Consider this example. Suppose you met and fell in love with Mary before ever meeting Susan. Though Susan has all or more of the same lovable qualities, your love of Mary can make you unavailable to fall for Susan. It's obvious to common sense that this depends on the entirely contingent fact that you met her first. But most lovers are reluctant to accept the contingency of their love. Your love for Mary will seem to you objectively necessary, just as it appears objectively necessary to the average follower of Islam or Catholicism that theirs is the only true religion. And yet, we can be virtually certain that each one, had they been switched at birth, would now, with equal devotion, hold the other view. It is part of the grip of limerence that we cannot imagine our devotion ever changing. In proceeding with the conceptual analysis of love, then, we must give some weight to what seems necessarily to be entailed by the feelings now gripping the lover. But we will not forget also to look at the lover dispassionately, from the outside, and ask what, from the observer's point of view, is and is not a necessary part of the concept of love. One such necessary aspect of limerence, it transpires, is that some of its firmest convictions will prove delusional. In Socrates' interrogation of Agathon, the following points are salient and relate to the conceptual analysis of love. Love is the love of something. Love is an intentional state. That term refers a state of mind that is about something, which may or may not exist. In this way, love is unlike a mood, for a mood, though it affects how you feel about everything, isn't about anything specific. It is also not like a pain. A pain in itself isn't about anything else, and is no less a pain if you have no idea what caused it. By contrast, it would make no sense to say, "I am madly in love, but I have no idea with whom." Having established that love is of someone, Socrates gets Agathon to grant that love involves desire of what one does not possess. This brings to the fore the role of desire, which will be the topic of the next chapter. But first, let me sum up this chapter by asking, what can we, nearly 2.5 millennia later, learn from Plato's Symposium? Apart from the specific insights touched on so far, the most important lesson to take away is that no single lesson will do. Each of the very different approaches to love exemplified in the discussion rings true at some level. Generally, however, none has much to say to the others. Exceptions to this arise when one character launches into exaggerations and banalities. Pausanias has an easy time showing that Phaedrus' account of the psychological benefits of love has eluded the darker side, and Socrates, with considerably more subtlety, refutes Agathon to show us that his conception of love as a god, perfectly beautiful and good, leaves out the component of desire that is central to love. This is no mere quibble. It lies at the heart of an easily forgotten aspect of the ideally good life. If love, or for that matter anything we value highly, is to affect our feelings and behavior in important ways, it must move us to desire. Desire, by definition, aims at something that doesn't actually exist. We saw how this is manifested in the ambiguity of the English word want. In one of its meanings, that word refers to a psychological state, which is intelligible only if it is directed at some non-existent state of affairs. One wants what one is in want of. Plato's way of explaining how we can seem to want things that we already have is plausible and correct, if by it we mean that we want to continue having it. Since we don't have any future states yet, this doesn't break the rule that we desire only what we do not have. In the next chapter, taking a tip from Diotima, we shall ask, what is it that a lover desires?